Good afternoon, everyone. Hi.
Hi.
Maybe the first one was difficult to say. Okay. You know, it seems like with some of the job sharing changes that are taking place in marriages, I thought I'd tell you this little story. There were a man and his wife were having an argument about who should brew the coffee each morning. The wife said, "You should do it because you get up first, and then we don't have to wait as long to get our coffee." So the husband said, "You're in charge of cooking around here, and you should do it because that's your job, and I can just wait for my coffee." The wife replies, "No, you should do it. And besides, it's in the Bible that the man should do the coffee." The husband replies, "I can't believe that. Show me." So she fetched the Bible and opened the New Testament and showed him at the top of several pages. It indeed says, "He brews." Now we know the truth. You know, when the knowledge of the Lord covers the earth like the waters cover the sea, we will be reigning as kings and priests. Well, what does that actually mean? Have you ever dreamed about it? What will I actually be doing? What will it be like to reign? What kind of leadership will we be giving at that time? In Acts 3, it talks about a restoration. Acts 3, verse 21. "Whom heaven must receive till the times of restoration of all things, which God has spoken by the mouth of all his holy prophets since the world began." When it says the restoration of all things, what things will be restored? And if things are to be restored, they must have existed in the past. You know, one of the things that we'll be doing is restoring simplicity to rulership. Simplicity will reign in all parts of society. I could have called this sermon probably Restoring Simplicity, but I didn't want to throw Mr. Barrett off because I had already given him a title. So let's look at some of the things we'll actually be simplifying. First, and probably the most important, is religion. The simplicity that is in Christ. Religion is supposed to be simple. In 2 Corinthians 11, if you'll turn there, be reminded of that scripture. 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 3. Paul writes, "But I fear lest somehow, as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, so your minds may be corrupted." He calls it a corruption, the corruption from the simplicity that is in Christ. God here implies that complexity is corruption, and much of standard religion out there today is complex. For instance, we ask the question, how many beings are there in the Godhead? All of us know, right? It's pretty simple, pretty easy to find out. Yet there are many religions today who say it's a mystery. There are three supposedly beings, but we don't understand really what it means, how we can really figure that out. You just have to take it on faith. But one of the things we'll just restore right away is just the understanding of who God is. We'll know by that time. Everybody will know by that time. We know right now by reading John 1. Let's take a look at that. The simplicity that is there and is so simple to understand. Yet we've just gone through a period in the last decade or so where there were individuals who wanted to make it very complex and study into it and get into the Greek, and we had to figure out exactly what does this really mean. It's pretty simple if you read it. John chapter 1, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and he was in the beginning with God." How simple is that? Extremely simple. When you try to make something complex and get into mysteries, supposedly, it clouds the issue. And God says that's a kind of a corruption. How about the law? What about the law? What are we going to say to people about the law of God? What does Christ say? Let's go to Matthew 5. Again, a very simple statement, but packed with meaning. Matthew chapter 5. Verse 17, do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For assuredly, I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Very simple statement. What do people want to do with it? They want to complicate it. Yeah, but it changes back here. He didn't really mean that. You know, he only meant that up until the time of when he was hanging on the stake, and of course it was all nailed. Try to make it complex. And Jesus is very, very simple, teaches it very simply. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so, shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. It won't be Wayne Gretzky who's going to be called the great one. It's not going to be Alexander the Great. It'll be Laurie the Great. Bob the Great is speaking next. Howard the Great is leading songs. Sarah the Great made my breakfast today. You know, it sounds kind of funny, doesn't it? But that's what Christ says is going to actually happen. We will have a name that is great. I don't know what our name is going to be exactly. None of us do, but I'm sure mine's going to be a lot better than it is right now. But that's simplicity, isn't it? You keep the law, and of course the Sabbath is part of the law. You keep that, and God says to you, you're going to be known as somebody who is great, great in the kingdom. For now, right now, it seems like a dream. God looks around, and he picks the simple and the weak of the earth, doesn't he? But he turns them into something different. We are going to be something totally different, and that's going to be great. And we will be known as the great. The Sabbath, of course, is part of that law. One other thing that we're going to make simple. We'll go through a number of different topics. One of the things, key areas that is going to be simplified is justice or judging. It has to be made simpler than it is today. Our injustice system is probably what we should call it. It's a sad kind of a mess that we have in our society. And it's one of the areas where our nations are actually condemned by God. Because he said, there is no justice. There's no justice. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 6. God is telling us that this time we are learning to judge properly. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 3. We need to build the kind of character and the kind of judgment that God wants us to have because we're going to be exercising it in the world tomorrow. We are going to be judges. We're going to be doing some of the straightening out of the mess that is out there today that's called justice. Do you not know that we shall judge angels? How much more things that pertain to this life? We're going to judge angels. I looked up the meaning of judging just because it always kind of puzzled me a little bit. What do you mean by judging angels? What does it mean to judge an angel? Are we going to sit there as a judge and say, this angel was bad, this one was good? It didn't make any sense. It's not the same term that we would think of as condemning or judging in a court of law. I looked up the meaning, and the Greek is krino. It means to distinguish or to decide. It can also mean avenge, accuse, or condemn. But I would probably put the term in there to direct. Judging angels would be more like, here's what I'd like you to do. Here's what I'd like you to do. After all, that's what they're there for, is to help and to assist. And we will be guiding how things are done. When you think of the incredible changes that are going to take place when there is proper judging going on, we will not have prisons anymore. Those are real hell holes on this earth, the prisons of the world. They're just horrible. And you think of how that will simplify things when you don't have prisons. It releases billions of dollars to be used profitably. It costs billions to keep people in jail like that. And what are the fruits of prisons? They produce more efficient criminals, and they corrupt the inmates more. Basically, just shooting yourself in the foot as a society to have prisons like that. far more sensible to make sure that somebody is sentenced correctly and then have them either work to pay off their debts or whatever. But that's pretty simple for us, isn't it? Because we're learning how to think. We're learning how to judge. And when you have the power to do that, it's going to change everything dramatically. There'll be no more waiting for a court case for sometimes years. And appeals and appeals and appeals and appeals. And somebody sitting on death row for maybe 13 or 14 or 15 years sitting on death row wondering whether he's going to get executed or not. Just ridiculous. We'll be able to handle things a lot quicker than that. There'll be no waiting times in courts. There'll be no more young offenders law in Canada, if I have anything to do with it. I'm sure if you are familiar with it and what's happened with the young offenders law, it's absolutely horrible what they've done. You have young kids now who are being recruited to run drugs, etc., because they suffer no real penalties. You've got gangs who are hiring little kids who are 10 years old to run drugs for them, or guns, or whatever it is. Because if they get caught, they don't get any penalty. There was one young man in Toronto who decided to shoot his father and mother. So he got a shotgun, went upstairs, killed both of them, was arrested for it, served 3 years in detention. Just terrible, and it encourages more troubles and more problems. So what does God tell us to do? Let's go to Exodus 21 and just take a look for a second, verse 1. God shows us and tells us that we are to exercise our brains, exercise our minds, by looking at His work, by looking at His Bible, and learning what kind of principles to use of judgment. Here He says, Exodus 21 and verse 1, "These are the judgments which you shall set before them." And if you go through here, it tells you what to do in certain cases. Now, we wouldn't use the same exact punishments because it was a different era. And we understand a lot more now by having the New Testament. And it actually changes our minds a little bit on the different things. But that's what God wants us to do. How do you judge? Use our brains, look at it and see, what does He say? Apply it, if you can, to this day. And if it changes a little bit in the New Testament, then you use that. You use those scriptures. But we have to become judges to understand. We must use Jesus as our example of judging. In Isaiah 11 and verse 3, talking about how He would judge. Isaiah 11 and verse 3. "He shall not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek of the earth." So why does God tell us in the New Testament, don't make judgments, harsh judgments, or quick judgments? Because He wants us to learn that, how to judge properly. You don't look at the circumstances and say, that looks like that person is doing such and such. Whoa. And make a judgment or a condemnation when we don't know. We don't know. So God tells us, don't make those kind of judgments. Learn to judge correctly. Learn to judge like me, is what Christ is saying. God gives guidelines in His Word, but we will have to make judgments using those guidelines. How will it work? Let's go to Isaiah 2 and we'll find out. Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 3. Here's how our rulership is actually going to work. Isaiah 2 and verse 3, it says, "Many people," notice what that says. It doesn't say all of the people. It says many. "Many people shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us His ways, and we shall walk in His paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." But you notice it doesn't say all. He says, many will come. There'll be many, many people who will want to come and learn. It's actually going to take a sort of a combination of the carrot and the stick to get everybody in line. Carrot and the stick, you remember the old story? Guy had a donkey, and sometimes he couldn't get the donkey to do what he wanted. So the old farmer had a friend, and his friend says, my donkey won't go half the time. How do you get yours to go? He says, I use a carrot and a stick. And I hang it out there in front of him. Watch, I'll show you. Takes a stick and he whacks the donkey over the head. Just about drops him. And then he holds the carrot up and away they go. And the guy says, I thought you just used a carrot. He says, yeah, but you got to get his attention first. Says, God is going to have to get the attention of some people, some nations, and it'll be a combination of a carrot and a stick. Let's go to Zechariah and see that. The principle of Zechariah 14 and verse 18. Sort of like the carrot and the stick. We zero in on Egypt, but it's interesting when you read it. It says, if the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague with which the Lord strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Verse 19. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So God says here, I'm going to have to perhaps use a stick and get their attention a little bit. The stick would be, in this case, no rain. So it might be more people than we think that may not come up, decide not to come up and keep the feast. But this is a general principle that God will use for all nations, and it's also a general principle in our dealings with individuals. We'll have to deal with people who do not want God's way. And we'll have to have some kind of a way of encouraging them, catching the bees with honey, maybe, whatever we can possibly do to try to encourage them to go God's way. But I don't think they're all going to suddenly just do exactly what we want them to do. When you assist people in the growth of character, you have to work with some who are perhaps not very cooperative. Let's go to that scripture we all know, Isaiah 30, verse 20. Isaiah 30, verse 20. Mr. Barrett, I'm drinking out of the glass on the right. So in Isaiah 30, verse 20, though the Lord gives you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, so there'll be some correction, yet your teachers will not be moved into a corner anymore. But your eyes shall see your teachers, and your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it. Whenever you turn to the right hand or whenever you turn to the left. So we have to ask the question, just how much choice are people going to have in the millennium still? I believe they'll have lots of choice. I don't think we're going to come up behind them and say, turn to the left, and they decide to go to the right, so we just smash them. Get that big stick and just get, boom, right across the head. If that's the case, how do they build character? If you tie a straitjacket on them, and you say, okay, I'm God now, and I'm telling you, you go to the left, and they go to the right, and you tie them in a straitjacket and you say, you're going that way. I don't know if you've ever thought about it, but I think there's going to be a lot more choice probably in the millennium than we realize. We think maybe just all nations are suddenly going to decide to follow God's way of life. If that's the case, why is it that Satan can pick off so many people at the end of the millennium? If everybody was going God's way and there was never any problems with anybody, how can he come out and suddenly just attract all these people to go and fight, go back to war again? I believe people will still have to make choices, and they'll have to build character. Otherwise, they're not going to have that character when it comes time to put them in God's family too. They're not going to have any character. They won't have the character that we have and that we've gained. So if we think we won't have a challenge, you know, the old idea of just being up in heaven and rolling around heaven all day and just enjoying ourselves on a cloud and floating around, staring into God's face forever. How boring. But we won't be bored. I believe we'll have a real challenge, because when you start working with people, you try to get them to go God's way and do everything you can to encourage them, to help them. They still oftentimes will go the other way, and they need a lot of help and a lot of direction. Just try to get a grade 9 class to do some work sometime when they're not in the mood. There's not much you can do. There's not much you can do, well, especially in our education system, which is going to change as well. If I have anything to do about it, it's going to change a lot, because we're stuck now with a system where you can't discipline virtually, and you can't really kick the kids out, because they got, by law, they have to be in there. They got to be learning by law, so then they have to go. You have to make some alternate teaching for them or something, or some gateway class, which we have in Valley View, and the kids go over there and just work on their own because they can't handle it in the classroom. It's pretty sad. The system is pretty sad. And we have so many kids who have special needs that they're putting back in the regular classes too. Let's look at another aspect that's going to change dramatically. Change things dramatically. We will be teaching tithing, not wretched income tax. I don't know what you think of doing income tax, but I get these programs and I have to go through all this stuff. And if you live in a certain zone, then you get a $7.50 credit per day. But if you're only there for this amount of time, you don't get it. And they give you all these kinds of different things. Imagine just administering 10%. No income tax, no filling out forms. Person just sends in their tithe. What a simplification that would be. No corporate tax. You wouldn't have to have all these people who are working in there, these accountants working in there, checking your taxes, and then they send you back a note 3 months later. We did it wrong. You need to send us another $840, or, you know, the good old tax system. Then they ask, how much does your wife make or your husband make? And we used to have the thing in Canada where you just donated money to the church and you took your receipt and sent it in. But they must have figured out that they were losing too much money. So now you've got to put it in there and you've got to say, divide by 7.6 and multiply by 7.2, and you find out you owe them money. I'm just kidding. But it's not as straightforward as it used to be, because it was just, you could just give you 10% and that was it. Imagine now, another area, no interest on money. You know, we have a mortgage, got interest, you just piles up, and then there's taxes, land taxes on top of that. Every year you got to pay this over and over again. Can you imagine borrowing money and having to pay no interest? Because there'll be no interest on the money that we borrow in the future. You know, Jesus said in John 8, verse 32, let's go there. Makes a lot of sense when you start realizing that the changes that are going to come about because of applying God's law and His ways and what's going to be done in the future. John 8, verse 32 says, the truth will make us free. You shall know the truth. Go back to verse 31. Jesus said to those Jews who believed Him, if you abide in My word, if you abide My word, if you go by what I'm teaching you, He says, this is going to actually change your life. You will know the truth. The truth will make you free. Imagine all these things we'll be free of. If you're a farmer, what's the worst thing you have as a farmer in many cases? Taxes. Taxes on the land, isn't it? If you don't make a cent, you lose money that year, what do you still have to pay? Still have to pay those taxes. They just keep mounting up. A lot of people lost their farms and lost their property in Canada in the 30s and the States only because of taxes. They couldn't afford to pay the taxes. lost. There are other reasons too, of course. They didn't have the kind of crops that they needed to pay the bills. Well, when you have the truth of God, it changes things dramatically. You can just imagine how it would free us if you didn't have to pay those taxes. How about having proper space to use around our houses? Let's go to Isaiah 5 and verse 8. Anybody live in zero clearance housing? That just irks me. That irks me so bad. Canada's got 3.6 million square miles of land. And what do? They let these developers put 500 zillion houses in this little quarter acre. So you look and you can't see through the houses in between them anymore. They got these zero clearance things. And it's just sad because it's so unnecessary. But Isaiah 5 and verse 8 says, "Woe to those who join house to house. They add field to field till there's no place where they may dwell alone in the midst of the land. And the apartment blocks are worse." We won't be building places like that. How about these? Imagine the time savers and how free you would be if you didn't have false teeth and glasses and keys. Statistics Canada says if seniors didn't have to search for teeth, glasses, or keys, they would have 13.5% more time in a day. I made that up. 42.3% of all statistics are made up on the spot. You see, God talks about redeeming the time. You know, you think about it in the world ahead. Are we going to need glasses? I don't know. There's still a possibility that people might, you know, sin enough to cause the kind of problems that... How many got glasses in here? Oh, yeah, yeah. We all have, I think, right? These things irritate me so much. I want to get rid of them someday. But we got false teeth. When you think about it, the Eskimos, you know, never had cavities. They were unheard of. Absolutely unheard of until they started eating the same foods we eat. Now you see them, you see pictures of them. They got no teeth at all, virtually. And they didn't have a cavity. They never had any. God's going to give us one pure language. Zephaniah 3 and verse 9. You can imagine what this is going to free us from. Zephaniah 3 and verse 9. "For then I was restored to the peoples." So here you go. Restore. You see another restoration. "I will restore to the peoples a pure language, that they all may call on the name of the Lord to serve him with one accord." Can you imagine how much time will be saved when we have the simplicity of no translations going on? You think of the United Nations and all the translating that has to be done. You think of Canada. Up about 6 or 7 years ago, I saw this statistic. And they have to translate everything up here into English and French. So if you're speaking French in Parliament, then they record it in French and they translate it into English. Everything has to be done that way. That's just Parliament. And it costs, at that time, it was $1 a page, $1 a page. And can you imagine how much paper they go through in Ottawa or the United Nations and the kind of cost, the kind of money that it costs? Yet God says he's going to give us a pure language. Can you imagine how much time will be saved when we have the simplicity of no translations? Less confusion and misunderstandings when you have a pure language. With English, you say something and somebody gets a completely different meaning than what you intended or whatever. Problems and difficulties. How about agriculture that's going to change? No genetically modified seed. Won't that be fun? You can actually go to a store and buy some seed and not be wondering what's in this stuff and is it going to work and is it fit to eat? You genetically modify stuff and you don't know what you're actually getting. I can just wait for the day. I'm just waiting for the day till Monsanto is out of business. You know who they are. They're the great big company that pushes this stuff dramatically. They came up with Roundup Ready canola. Now, is this sort of a normal and logical thing to do? You plant a crop, and after it gets growing, gets to a certain height, you come and spray it with really strong herbicides. Nothing will grow in that ground except the canola, because they played with the genetics and they figured out how they were going to do it, and somehow they did it so that that particular herbicide, though it's strong, it's Roundup, it'll kill anything. You get it near your garden or anything like that, it's done. But it won't hurt the canola. And the canola grows and therefore gets more moisture, so you get a better crop. You make a little more money. All money. And then they make you sign a paper saying that they can come onto your land and check to see if you've got any of their seed. And they sign these papers for, I think it's 5 years or something like that. They can come in and inspect. And if you have any, they can sue you. If you don't pay them for that seed or that crop, then they can sue you and get their money back out of you, whatever. Not quite the way I would say God would do things. Not quite the way we would do anything. We have seeds and we garden all the time. We're always gardening every year. And we go and buy seed, and some of it just doesn't work anymore. We planted peas, wouldn't come up at all. One plant out of a row came up, actually, I shouldn't lie. One plant came up out of a whole row. So we had planted them again, and they still didn't do very well. We're not sure whether it's the seed or what's going on. I've talked to other people, same thing, that you buy these seeds for even zucchinis and stuff like that, and they won't grow in some cases. So you wonder, what are they actually doing? You know, there is abundance locked up in the seeds already, in the natural, normal seeds that God has created and given to us. There's abundance locked in that genetics, in that code. All you have to do is do it right. Give the right kind of nourishment, the right kind of watering, and those plants will produce magnificent amounts of food. I did it one time with potatoes. I got called potato head after that. But I grew these potatoes one time. We were living in Sexsmith, up near where we are now. And these people had done some developing, so I asked if I could have some of that extra topsoil. So I got some topsoil and piled it in there, about 2 or 3 feet of it, over my whole yard. Then I got a truck, a friend had a truck, so I went and got some of the manure that this farmer had. It was just that black stuff that was all totally rotted and just perfect stuff, and I got 2 3-ton trucks loads, and I put them on the garden. So we planted potatoes. And while they were growing, we just noticed, I healed them and all that kind of thing, and they were pretty big, you know, the green part was pretty big. But when we came to harvest, every one of those plants had a potato in the center, about like that. I said it was as big as my head, that's why they said Mr. Potato Head. So. But every plant had a potato about that size. My wife will tell you, I'm not lying. We put them on our kitchen table, they wouldn't hold them. And they were all perfect. There was no hollow spot or anything in there. And each of the plants had about another 20 or 30 potatoes as well. That were good, real good sized potatoes. So it shows you what can be done. But the problem is, you see, what does man do? He puts in a field of zillion acres of potatoes. What does that do? First of all, it attracts a tremendous number of bugs. If you don't nourish a plant properly, you plant a whole ton of them like that in great big vast fields, you'll encourage bugs. So what do then? Spray for the bugs. Kill the bugs, but they also kill the birds that eat the bugs. Then they get into a vicious cycle, so it happens more and longer. So what do they do then? Because of their poor farming practices, they then go back and work with the potatoes genetically, find out how they can manipulate it so they resist bugs more. Not actually solving the problem, but I don't want to eat those potatoes, because you don't know what's really there. If God's given us a potato and a natural potato, that's what I want. That's what I'd like to eat. Because you're going to have better health, and we know that for sure. But the changes that are going to take place in farming are going to be dramatic. We're not going to have those vast acreages. There'll be smaller farms, that kind of thing. We will be teaching proper farm practices, like the land Sabbath, for one thing. Proper crop rotation, no artificial fertilizers, What's going to be the basis for our teaching? Let's go to 1 Corinthians 13. In all of our judging, in all of our teaching, all the things that we're going to be doing in the, as part of God's family and as part of our reigning duties, being kings and priests and judges, what's going to drive us? All of you know, don't you? It's going to be love. If you really love people, you wouldn't be doing some of the things you're doing today. Not us, but the way the world is doing things. The agriculture, the judging, the crime that's out there. If people really loved one another, and this was the basis, it would change their whole approach dramatically. Let's just read a little bit about it. God's talking here about not being hypocrites and learning what he's writing to us. How do you order your life? How do I order my life? Though I speak with the tongues of men and have angels and have not love, I have become as a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. Something is clanging like that and keeps on going. It would be irritating. It just irritates you, doesn't it? Maybe it irritates God. Verse 2, though I have the gift of prophecy, understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith, so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I'm nothing. I'm nothing. Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. Verse 4, love suffers long. It's kind. Love does not envy, does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, or is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. It'll never fail. If we use it and it's part of our makeup that we practice, it never fails. Whether there's prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part will be done away. Verse 12, for now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know just as I also am known. We know a little bit about what we're going to be doing in the future. It's going to be wonderful responsibilities. And this is what needs to drive us. Now abide faith, hope, love, these three. But the greatest of these is love. It's going to be our modus operandi, our MO. That's what it has to be. God says it identifies us when we have love for one another as his people. There is a time coming, brethren, that is almost unbelievable, a marvelous time when the righteous will reign. Let's look forward to the time when Isaiah 11 and verse 9 is actually fulfilled. The knowledge of the Lord covers the earth like the waters cover the sea. And his way will be taught and practiced by his people when the righteous reign.